It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, new research finds high suicide rates among older white men. We'll talk to a suicide researcher about the possible causes.
But first, the Wisconsin State Senate passed a number of high-profile bills last night after a long session, including funding cuts to Planned Parenthood and changes to the state's civil service system. WPR Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson joins us for a roundup. Hi, Sean.
Hey, Veronica.
Well, Sean, the big bill in the room last night was the overhauling of Wisconsin's 100-year-old civil service system, and that bill passed along partisan lines. Tell us about what that bill would do.
Yeah, this bill would be a pretty big rewrite of the civil service system. And basically, I think that overall, it makes it easier to hire and easier to fire in Wisconsin state government positions, in civil service positions. So part of the way that it would do that is it would have just a faster timeline for hiring. It would allow for people doing the hiring to forego what right now they have to administer this civil service exam. Under this plan, they would move to a resume-based system. And it would also just kind of, in a number of ways, it would give supervisors more discretion for firing people. And ultimately, decisions over dismissal would be centralized with political appointees within the Department of Administration.
And Sean, you gave us some audio of the back and forth on this one. Here's a taste.
What I've heard time and time again from agency folks is that it takes far too long to hire an employee here at the state.
There's going to be an exodus. There's a lack of respect. And it's creating fear. And that's the thing that concerns me the most.
And what are we hearing there?
So you heard a couple voices there. That was Roger Roth, the first person to speak. He was the Senate Republican author of this plan. And he emphasized during the debate on this bill that this was really all about modernizing the hiring system in Wisconsin, that state agencies have said it takes too long to hire people. And so that's what Republicans have emphasized kind of in the closing days of this, that it's really about modernizing the hiring system. Democrats said that was Janice Ringhan, you heard, a Democrat from Janesville. They have stressed that, okay, but what you're going to do is create a system where every state worker is going to be kind of living in fear of saying something that politically could get them in trouble, that because it's so much easier to dismiss state workers now under this plan than it was previously, that there would always be that that worry in state government that you've got to do what you think your supervisor thinks is politically expedient.
How sharp was the debate on this one last night?
I mean, I think this is one that, especially you heard it from some Democrats, they definitely don't like this, especially Democrats with the number of state employees in their district. They kind of had, there was an I told you tone to some of their comments, an I told you so tone, excuse me, because this is something where when the governor was advancing Act 10 a few years ago, he said, well, look, even though we're making all these changes to union bargaining rights, Wisconsin still has the strongest civil service laws in the nation, and we're not touching those. Here, you know, a few years later, civil service laws will remain, but they're going to be drastically different than they were. And so Democrats are saying this is all kind of part of a pattern, that there's been this continued erosion of state worker rights. Republicans weren't arguing quite as, you know, as feverishly on the Senate floor. And I mean, part of that is because at this point in the stage, at this stage in the bill, they know that they've got the votes. It's already passed the assembly. They kind of worked out any issues behind closed doors, and it's going to go to the governor for his signature.
We're talking to Sean Johnson right now, WPR Capitol Bureau Chief. He's telling us about a few of the bills passed in the state Senate last night and another couple of bills we should talk about. These also party line votes. A pair of bills aimed at cutting the funding to Planned Parenthood. Tell us about those.
Yeah, they would take away, or they're aimed at cutting federal funding specifically for Planned Parenthood in a couple ways. One would reduce what Planned Parenthood gets reimbursed for prescription drugs. So right now, Planned Parenthood and other family planning clinics get their drugs at discounted rates available through a federal Medicaid program. The bill that passed the Senate would cut off that discount for Planned Parenthood And so it could cost them an estimated $4 million a year in lost federal funding. The other bill would cut their federal Title X funding, which is for low-income men and women. You know, again, these are the way that they're drafted. It doesn't exactly say Planned Parenthood in the bill, but they are drafted specifically to cut federal funding for Planned Parenthood and kind of go about it in an indirect way by going after these programs.
And Wisconsin Planned Parenthood has gotten some of these funds, it sounds like, for 35 years. So what kind of an impact will this have on the services?
Well, what you're hearing from Planned Parenthood and from Planned Parenthood supporters is that in some areas, this change is going to be felt pretty dramatically, that if you live in an underserved part of Wisconsin where, health care is not as easy to come by, that you're going to notice it when a Planned Parenthood clinic has a harder time offering you these services. And, you know, a loss of about $7 million a year is a financial hit to this organization. So their advocates are saying this is something that you may feel in those parts of the state.
And you gave us a sense of the debate on this one, too. Tell us a little bit about what we're going to hear.
Yeah, this will be Republican Senator, Dewey Strobel, who arguing in favor of the plan. He's saying that, look, other organizations can pick up the slack where Planned Parenthood leaves off. And he's followed up by Ashland Democrat Janet Bewley, who thought that was a bit callous.
I support women's health care. I think everybody else here supports women's health care, too. But what we don't support is a taxpayer subsidy to a private abortion provider.
I'm astonished by the unwillingness to walk a mile in someone else's shoes and to acknowledge that there are parts of the state that don't look like where you might live.
And moving on from that one, Sean, another bill in the Senate yesterday, there was some legislation affecting strip search procedures for law enforcement. Can you tell us a little bit about what that one's about?
I think it would allow for more strip searches than you have right now. And then, you know, more specifically, it would undo part of a law that was passed last session that makes police wait 12 hours before they can conduct a strip search on suspects who've been detained. So, right now, police can arrest somebody, they can be a suspect, and police say that they might have to put that person into solitary confinement rather than strip search them to make sure that they don't have any weapons on their person. This person would let police conduct strip searches on suspects who are being detained, regardless of whether they're being charged with a misdemeanor or a felony.
And that one got some pushback from critics as well. What have opponents said about it?
Yeah, particularly from Milwaukee Democrats and particularly from Milwaukee's African-American Democratic senators who said, you come to our city and see, realistically how strip searches are used and how they're used specifically against African-American men, that they say that this is a tool that police overused there, and this isn't a time when we should be expanding the ability of police to conduct strip searches. If anything, we should be going the other direction.
And Sean, finally, it was just announced this morning that Wisconsin's general fund balance is projected to be $94.4 million less than expected. Obviously, this is not good news, but how big a hit is this?
What it's going to mean probably is that, you know, in a context of a two-year budget that all funds is more than $70 billion, it's leaving the state with just $135 million cushion in its general fund. So that's not a big cushion. But as far as, what's it going to force the legislature to do? Nothing right now. I mean, as long as they kind of hang tight and as long as that estimate holds, there's money in the bank, but there's not much money, and there's less money than was projected. And the reason is not great for the state. The Fiscal Bureau says the reason that we're projected to have less money is because a downturn in tax collections.
Sean, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
That was Sean Johnson, WPR Capital Bureau Chief, telling us about a few of the bills that were passed in the state Senate last night.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up after the news, we'll find out how we learn to like some foods, dislike others, and how we can train ourselves and our children to enjoy healthier eating.
First, in the United States in 2014, there were nearly 43,000 suicides, according to the Centers for Disease Control. It's the 10th leading cause of death and the second leading cause of death for people between the ages of 15 and 24.
While there's been a concerted effort to prevent suicide among young adults, there's also a growing body of work that examines suicide rates in the senior population.
New research that shows a high prevalence of suicide among white male seniors is drawing attention to that demographic group. Sylvia Sarah Canetto has new research out. She's a professor of psychology at Colorado State University. She's dedicated her career to studying suicide. Sylvia, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me to do this interview.
So you've written this higher rate of suicide among white men in the senior population. Was this a surprise to you to find this out?
In some ways, I've been studying suicidal behavior since the 80s, and I have noticed in the course of my lifelong, in many ways, pursuit of the question about suicidal behavior, kind of a paradox, which is that older men of European descent, so-called white men, have significantly higher rates of suicide than any other demographic group in the United States. Their suicide rates are significantly higher than those of older men of other ethnic descent, particularly relative to older men of African descent, as well as relative to women older women across ethnicities. Just to give you some examples, men of European descent in their 70s have rates of suicide around 30 per 100,000 and climbing as they get older, while men of African descent in their 70s have rates of suicide around 10 per 100,000. If you look at men of European descent age 85 and older, their rates of suicide are around 50 per 100,000, while men of African descent 85 and older rate of suicide still around 10 per 100,000. If you look at women within those age groups, women in their 70s have rates of suicide of about 5 per 100,000 or lower, with African descent and indigenous descent, women have been the lowest rate in their 70s. By age 85, women of African descent, age 85, have rates of less than 1 per 100,000.
And Sylvia, how do these rates for older white men compare to younger people? Because we hear more, I think, about suicide among people, teens, 20s, 30s. Do their rates compare?
There is quite a bit of variability among different ethnic groups with regard to rates of suicide in the young adult and in adolescent groups as well, but with different patterns. Among young persons, individuals of indigenous descent have the highest rate, and we still see males as having higher rates than females, but it is person of indigenous descent. So for both groups, we see an intersection of ethnic as well as cultural factors as providing a different pattern depending on with regard to suicidal behavior, suicide mortality.
So for these older white men, you write that there's kind of a paradox here because when you think of risks of suicide, white men have lower risk, we would think, compared to people of, as you mentioned, African-American descent. They tend to have more resources, more money, maybe better health even. So that's kind of surprising. So why do we see a higher rate of suicide there?
Right, so traditional theories of older adult suicide have tended to point to the so-called adversities of aging or losses of aging, as well as depression, as related to high rates of suicide. People will say, well, being older comes with a lot of challenges and adversities and losses, and people get demoralized and therefore become suicidal. But if you look at the very diverse pictures of suicide rates that I just gave you, it seems to be kind of a paradox with regard to older men of European descent having higher rates of suicide. So my questions were, do they face greater adversities? Do they have individual factors associated with their suicidal vulnerability? Could there be cultural factors or issues related to method? And among my findings were that men of European descent have fewer burdens associated with aging collectively, I'm not saying individually. They are less likely to experience widowhood than older women, for example. They have better better physical health and fewer disability than older women. They have more economic resources than ethnic minority older men and then older women across ethnicities. And older men do not have higher rates of mental disorders nor higher rates of depression than older women. Among the findings of my research is also that there are differences in women and men with regard to psychological resilience, sense of self, as well as ways of coping. Research shows that men of European descent who die by suicide had a so-called narrow view of the self and rigid ways of coping. They were often described as inflexible, close to new experience, emotionally unaware, as well as emotionally constricted. They seem to be people who may be broke instead of bending. There are also indications that men of European descent may be less psychologically equipped to deal with the normal challenges of aging than women or ethnic minority men, possibly because they may have had less practice coping with life adversities and challenges than women and ethnic minority men. One important factor in men's psychological brittleness or rigidity, as well as their propensity for suicide as they reach late life, may be what I've called dominant scripts of masculinity, aging, and suicide. By scripts, I mean norms and expectations and beliefs and attitudes. There are scripts of masculinity, there are scripts of aging, there are scripts of suicide, and there are scripts of masculinity, aging, and suicide. My research has documented that European Americans endorse three main suicide beliefs. One is that suicide is more acceptable when the person is an older adult. Another one is that the suicide is more acceptable when the person is ill or has a disability. And the third one is that suicide is masculine behavior, meaning that male suicide is more acceptable, more powerful, less foolish, and more courageous than female suicide.
We're talking to Sylvia Saracinetto. She's a professor of psychology at Colorado State University, talking about high suicide rates among older white men. And Sylvia, I want to say some of this back to you because this seems huge. So we've got older white men, maybe as they hit these health issues and aging, they don't have the resilience, you're saying. They haven't maybe had these challenges throughout life that the other demographic groups, so they don't have a mode for dealing with these kind of problems. And then they turn to these scripts of masculinity. You either tough it out, or it's seen among some that suicide is an acceptable alternative to aging. Am I saying that back right to you?
Yeah. So both less practice, perhaps, coping and dealing with adversity, as well as the social expectations, social norms that prescribe that a man who is masculine, a man of European descent who is masculine, needs to react to the adversity of aging by not bending, by defying it, by fighting it, and responding to it possibly, and with suicide being a relatively powerful, courageous, and rational response to the so-called indignity of age. So the combination of the two seems to be putting men of European descent, as they get older, at risk for suicide as a way of coping.
So with that as the problem, Sylvia, and with the goal of reducing this high rate of suicide among older white men, what do we do with this information? How do we change those scripts that you're talking about?
I think it is important, first of all, to make visible these implicit and unconscious and unaddressed and unexamined scripts that we live by, these social norms and these social beliefs that may seem innocuous, but in reality influence our behavior. So first, it needs to be recognized that certain dimensions of, unquote, white man masculinity, such as the being in control or being autonomous at every cost, are dangerous to men's health. They may interfere with constructive coping and even threaten men's survival. We also need to make visible and challenge the so-called indignities of aging suicide script, as well as the belief that suicide may be a white man's powerful and rational response to aging and illness. How do we do that? Education is certainly one vehicle. We can think about primary prevention ways of education as well as secondary prevention. In terms of primary prevention, we can think about a public education campaign about older adult suicide that incorporates as a suicide risk that needs to be monitored, adherence to belief that suicide is a masculine response to aging and illness. With regard to secondary prevention, we can think about incorporating in psychotherapy with older adult men at risk for suicidal behavior, examination of dysfunctional beliefs and dysfunctional coping, and consideration of constructive beliefs about the self, including in terms of dysfunctional beliefs, that believe that suicide is a dignified and acceptable, permissible response for a man who is older and ill.
Sylvia, thanks a lot for sharing your research with us today.
You're welcome.
That was Sylvia Saracinetto. She's a professor of psychology at Colorado State University, looking at high suicide rates among older white men. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. We all know that person who just loves olives or who absolutely will not eat that slice of pizza if there are any mushrooms on it. But where do these taste preferences come from?
Her next guest may have some answers, and she says it's possible to actually change our tastes for certain foods and ultimately train ourselves and our kids to be healthier eaters. Joining us now is Bea Wilson. She's the author of the new book, First Bite, How We Learn to Eat. Her book draws on the research of psychologists, scientists, and historians to show us why we eat the way we do, for better or worse. Bea, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, a lot of us think of eating as an act of instinct and that our preferences for certain foods or dislikes of others is being pretty much built in. But you write that, no, we learn what to eat and what to like to eat. How do we learn these food preferences?
Well, we learn it from the earliest days of childhood onwards. And you're absolutely right. I think most of us think of our likes and dislikes as some kind of quirk of personality. We say, I'm a chocoholic, or I'm a meat lover, or we kind of make friends with other people that hate licorice. And it becomes such a strong part of our identity that we don't imagine it could ever change. But if you look into the process of how we actually learn to eat, it seems that almost all of our tastes are a function of exposure. But some of it's the exposure that's happened to us when we were babies, long before we're conscious that this is what's happening. So it even happens in utero. There was an amazing experiment done with pregnant mothers where they were asked to drink a lot of carrot juice in the last trimester of pregnancy. And they actually went on to have babies who, when they took their first bites of solid food, preferred carrot-flavoured cereal. It was as if they'd been imprinted with these wonderful memories of how great carrot tasted.
Well, I guess what you're describing here is part of why we should be easy on ourselves when we're trying to change our eating habits, because these aren't things that you can just shrug off at a moment's notice if you've been learning them since in utero, right? So what does that tell us
Absolutely.
About how to change habits?
Yeah, you've really put your finger on it. We should be so much kinder to ourselves and not talk in these awful moralistic terms about sort of saying that because we want some chocolate cake that somehow makes us naughty, or talking about foods being virtuous or bad. It's not that at all. And as you say, this is a question of habits and preferences which we've acquired over a lifetime, and it's not very easy to drop preferences at will. But the good news is it is possible to modify them over time and completely change your relationship with food. And I know I did it. That was part of my starting point for writing the book. Looking back and thinking, as a teenager, I used to be seriously unhappy about food. I was a compulsive eater. There was no stop button. If there was cake or pastries in the house, there was no question of me just having one slice. And it was partly a response to living with my sister, who was anorexic. I sort of felt somebody needed to be eating. And it was partly to do with lots of other things. But somehow, over a period of time, it wasn't about going on a diet. I changed my relationship with food. I found that it was okay to eat a hearty meal without feeling guilty. And I learned how to stop when I was full. And I feel so grateful now, looking back, that I've somehow acquired a whole new set of eating skills. And I can totally see it's got nothing to do with willpower or any of these other categories we kind of impose on ourselves to beat ourselves up. It's a form of learning, and it creates this huge divide that we hardly talk about in our food culture between those of us who find the whole matter of eating in a fairly balanced way quite easy, quite straightforward, and people who find it really difficult.
Yeah, right. B, I think the choice often is I'm going to stop eating the really good food that I enjoy and eat the really awful stuff, but that's healthy, and that's the road to healthy eating. And you're saying, no, take that healthy stuff and figure out how we can appreciate it, right?
Absolutely. You've put it so well. There's this polarity in our food culture, which is health is one thing, pleasure is another thing. Well, how are we ever meant to eat better if we think that? Because we all need a little comfort in this life. This is where most diets go wrong. And I found some really interesting studies. Sometimes people say diets never work. No one succeeds in losing weight long term. That's not true. It looks as if around a fifth of people that need to lose weight, large amounts of weight, do succeed in keeping it off. But one of the things is that they don't so rigidly force themselves to eat these foods that go against their own preferences. They keep some of their comfort foods going, but then slowly, through a process of kind of reconditioning, their palates change to the point where those super fatty, super salty, super sweet foods don't appeal to them so much anymore. And at that point, it's really easy not to eat the fast food because you're not resisting it. You're just thinking, no, that doesn't really speak to me.
We're talking right now with Bea Wilson. She is the author of First Bite, How We Learn to Eat. And Bea, speaking of learning to eat, how do you learn to appreciate asparagus, say, if you don't like it? What if you are someone? I know people who literally have aversions to vegetables. These are grown adults. They don't enjoy them. They don't want to eat them. How do you turn something that's been viewed as a disgusting food into something that you draw pleasure from?
It's really difficult. There's a few different ways. And I think maybe a strategy for adults might be different than a strategy for kids. I mean, I've spoken to adults who, it's a huge hidden problem of adult picky eaters who are stuck in very limited tastes and sometimes will even refuse invitations to eat with friends because they genuinely might gag at new food on their plate. And often vegetables are the problem food. With that, some people I've spoken to who have succeeded in learning to like vegetables and recalibrate their palates as adults. One guy said to me, I decided I wasn't going to eat any of the vegetables that I associated with childhood. So he didn't eat green beans or carrots. He only ate vegetables which he would never have seen as a child, such as butternut squash and sugar snap peas. That worked for him. But there's another revolutionary technique which has been incredibly successful. It's quite new. It was only pioneered over the last 10 years and it's been used on kids, but it does also seem to work on adults when the motivation is there. And it's called tiny tastes. And the thought is, just as you said, if you hate asparagus, you really don't want to put asparagus in your mouth because that's horrible. It's not a pleasant experience. And we know that the way we get to like new foods is through exposure. But it only works when the exposures feel positive, and just the act of putting asparagus in your mouth doesn't feel positive. But if you can somehow reduce the piece of food, asparagus or broccoli, whatever it might be, down to the size of a pea or even a grain of rice, suddenly it's possible to put it in your mouth. And you can do this multiple times. And I did it with my own youngest child, who was by far my pickiest eater. He was born with cleft palate, which didn't help. I was much more anxious about him, which also didn't help. And I was amazed. I thought this sounds too simple to be true. But he somehow didn't feel offended by trying something when it was that small. And it converted into eggplant, cabbage, omelettes. We're still working on spinach and quite a few others. So it's not like you're going to get there straight away.
Well, as a parent, I've done some of that right. So good for me. But bad for me, I think there are times when the kid doesn't eat something, it raises the stakes, raises some anxiety and drama at the table. That's not going to help anybody, is it?
No, but it's so hard not to react. And we also need to sort of get beyond the guilt of feeding. I've made masses of mistakes, some of which I talk about in the book, with feeding my own three kids. And it's very hard not to let the emotions of the situation get to us because we love our children so much. Feeding is such a primal emotion. We want to see them fed. We've put time and effort into trying to produce a halfway nourishing meal, and we don't want to see it chucked on the floor or rejected, and that's not very pleasant. So it's very hard. But yeah, the more you can somehow see that the end goal here is to make eating fun and that you're actually trying to raise someone who feels so good about vegetables that one day they'll choose them of their own accord, that changes things.
We're talking with Bea Wilson. She's the author of the new book, First Bite, How We Learn to Eat, and we'd like to hear from you.
Are you a picky eater, or maybe you're struggling with changing bad eating habits? What have you done to change the way that you think about food? Or maybe you've got some advice on teaching your kids to actually enjoy healthy foods. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation with author Bea Wilson about her latest book, First Bite, How We Learn to Eat.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Is there a food as a grown-up or a kid that you just can't eat? You know it's healthy. You know it's good for you. It disgusts you. You don't want anything to do with it. We'd love to hear about that. Have you had success or failure in trying to feed healthy food to your kids? What went right? What went wrong? Or have you successfully adapted your own self to eat a new kind of food? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And B, one question as we have this discussion is, how should we think about food? You write that our culture is food obsessed. Even food writers and chefs are obsessed with food in a way that might not be so healthy. And then you've got the obesity problem on the other hand. So how do you go forward from that, still enjoy food, but have a healthy relationship?
Well, I think the good news is that when you change your eating habits for the better, you don't get there through a state of denial and guilt. You actually get there through pleasure. You get there through sort of a sensory exploration of new foods. And I also know, speaking for myself, when you're stuck in disordered ways of eating, including overeating, mealtimes themselves are not such a pleasure. You know, you might be eating a lot of food and people call that indulgence, but I can tell you it doesn't feel like indulgence when you're trapped in habits of dependency. Whereas I've found once you, it takes time, it takes a lot of time, but once you've got to the point where you think, I can stretch the hours out between meals a bit longer and actually feel a little bit more hungry for my meals, you enjoy them so much more. But it's no wonder that so many of us have disordered relationships with food, whether it's overeating, undereating, anorexia, all of the extreme forms of picky eating. Because as you say, our culture is itself very dysfunctional in the relationship with food. We're kind of encouraged to demonize many of the foods that we love the most. And it's sometimes really hard to unpack the emotions of eating. You know, if you look at something like hunger, that seemed to me before I started writing the book that it should be something really simple, really instinctive, just like breathing. And then you look into the science of it and there are all these complex biomarkers, these hormones. But scientists haven't really put their finger on how you can absolutely objectively tell when someone is hungry or not, because hunger isn't really an objective state. It's highly subjective. Sometimes the thing we were hungry for was actually love or home or security.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Karen on the line in Elk Mound. Karen, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
Well, I just wanted to share that my ex-husband, when I was married to him, he always said he couldn't eat fruits or vegetables because he was allergic to them. And his mother had been allergic to them also. And it made their throat itch. Well, I don't think he liked vegetables, so he used it as an excuse. Mm. And one of my children growing up saw him eat more frequently and develop the same habit of not eating fruits and vegetables.
Karen, thanks so much for that call. And that reminds me of something you mentioned in your book, for a parent, the best way to instill good eating habits is to model good eating habits.
Yeah, absolutely. But then this is so hard because so many of us have our own baggage around food. I think that's a really important point that that listener made, because one of the, other than exposure, which is the single best way you get to like new foods, the second best way is social conditioning. So this can work in a really positive way. If you see a parent modeling, enjoying eating a range of foods, whether it's vegetables or just other wholesome home-cooked food, that's going to be way more powerful than any lecture on healthy eating. But equally, if you see a parent modeling a dysfunctional relationship with food, it's really hard to get beyond that. That was an important point for someone to raise.
Don't you also say at some point, if you can't get your kids to eat them any other way, it's okay to lie? And you talk about, is it Denmark where they tell a lie about carrots?
It's Hungary. I mean, I'm half joking, but I also, so I'm saying, I don't really get why governments think that the way to get adults to change their eating habits is constantly to give us this advice and lectures. And it's, I'm saying, you know, it's as if we say to a child, I strongly advise you to eat that cabbage and follow it with a glass of milk. That doesn't work. The way that you get a child to eat better is example, patient exposure, and lots of repetitions. But when that fails, you lie. And in Hungary, Hungarian friends have told me the way they get kids to eat carrots is they tell them, eat carrots and you'll be able to whistle. And apparently they eat a lot of carrots in Hungary. So I sort of think those kind of lies, it's in a way, what I see that as being is a sort of tiny bit of pro-healthy food propaganda to offset against the mass of food propaganda we're given in the opposite direction. If you think of all the messages a child is exposed to about, you know, you see these adverts of these wonderful godlike athletes drinking sugary beverages and cartoon characters who are so cute on the boxes of these sugary cereals. So, yeah, a few little white lies, but I'm not really saying lie. The other stuff, the social conditioning and the exposure should be enough.
We'll go back to our callers now. We've got Cindy on the line in Milwaukee. Cindy, hi.
Yes, hi there. I have to admit that I used psychology on my kids when they were younger. I would push the bowl of vegetables away from them. I'm like, I'm sorry, you're not old enough. Like, I'm old enough. I'm like, okay. So then I'd give them some. Of course, they liked it because they were old enough.
That's kind of genius.
Yeah, I don't
know. That's really clever.
It just seems like there's got to be a downside there somewhere. But if it worked for Cindy, I guess that's okay, B.
I think it's brilliant. I think actually the more open-minded we can be and just mix things up completely, because so many of our problems, another listener on a different radio show I was doing phoned in and said, you know, we have this thing that we say, eat your broccoli and then you can have some ice cream. And that just makes the ice cream into a huge treat and the broccoli into something unpleasant. She said every time her son did some great homework or practiced his musical instrument, she gave him a cup of vegetables. So he associated it with a kind of like a prize. Hmm. I think it's amazing. I would never quite dare do that myself because maybe I'm not as free and open-minded. But yeah, use psychology all you can.
We've got a comment here on Facebook, I think. Mary says, I completely agree with B. I hated broccoli, cauliflower, and Brussels sprouts as a kid and as adult, and recently tried Romanesco broccoli, and it was so different, I loved it. Now I eat cauliflower and Brussels sprouts too, still working on broccoli, but the Romanesco did the trick. So I guess she was trying sort of the tiny taste model where she just keeps trying new things.
Yeah, that's really good to hear. And also that model of if those old vegetables have bad associations, just try something new. That's great.
Talking to Bea Wilson about her book, First Bite, How We Learn to Eat. Back to your calls now with Terry in West Bend. Terry, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Terry?
Well, when I was raising my kids, and they're both in their 20s now, I never made them eat something that they didn't want to eat, but they had to put it in their mouth. If they didn't want to try it, they could spit it out, but they had to at least try. And they are the most adventurous eaters I know now, because they're not afraid.
Did they often spit the things out, Terry?
Actually, they didn't, because they knew they could.
Wow, that's great. Thank you so much for sharing that. The only food my kids have spat out that I've made is the infamous celeriac slaw. And I can't blame them. I could eat it, but it wasn't really that good. But that kind of trust and that permission not to like things, B, sounds like a good idea.
That's huge. I think, I mean, part of the tiny taste idea, but clearly this listener had invented it all by herself. The more we can take pressure off the kids to somehow perform or to feel that they've got to eat something, the better. Because it's dinner time, it's so emotional for both the kids and the adults. So I think that's great. Put something in your mouth, but you don't have to eat a whole portion. Because actually the end game isn't about the next 5 minutes and how much they eat at this or that meal. It's about hoping that they'll grow up to be an adult who chooses these things of their own accord.
And we've got a caller here. We've got Ibrahim on from Sun Prairie. Hello there.
Hello.
Hi, and I've heard that there is a food that you do not like. What is it?
It's called supa.
Supa. What is supa?
Oh, it's a special type of rice sauce that's green.
A green rice sauce. And have you tried it? Have you tried the tiny taste? And how old are you? I should ask you that, too.
I'm trying a tiny bit. and I'm 8 years old.
Tried a tiny bit. Okay, so there you go, B. He's tried a tiny bit. What advice do you have for him?
Good for him. I mean, I think also the thing to remember, if you're only 8 years old, you've got a long way to go. So sometimes adults are really trying to hurry their kids into having the same range of tastes that we do. But if the things we like are mainly what we've been exposed to, well, you're only eight. You haven't had many opportunities to try it. So the fact you've tried it once doesn't mean you're not going to like it again in the future. Just, yeah, keep going.
Well, thank you so much for that call.
And Beth, Bea, in our last minute, we can be healthier and we can enjoy our food. That seems to be the core message you're trying to spread here.
Yeah, it is. And I was so delighted. The more research I did, the more I found out it's possible. It really can be done, but it requires a change of mindset. You know, once you see that eating is something we've learned, you weren't born loving cupcakes. Your taste isn't destiny. It's possible to learn new tastes and still be the same person, but to have a happier, more balanced relationship with food. And given that we're all eating three meals a day, give or take, that's a really great place to reach.
Bea, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We were talking there with Bea Wilson. She's the author of First Bite, How We Learn to Eat.
And you can keep sharing your thoughts and your food likes, dislikes, and how they've changed over the years over at the Central Time Facebook page.
Hi, everyone. I'm Olaf, and I like warm hugs.
Well, today is a very special day on the calendar for Rob and Olaf, I guess, in particular. It is National Hugging Day.
Yay.
Right. Well, so behind the scenes secret here, Rob, you are not a big fan of the hugs. You're not celebrating today with hugs. Occasionally, someone will hug you without asking, which is always pretty entertaining for the rest of us.
It has happened from time to time. I have healthy boundaries. I'm not anti-hug. I recognize the benefits of the hug.
You're a little anti-hug.
I do not seek them out. There have been awkward moments with coworkers, staff members, and I don't want to be like a
when
bad
you
guy.
Cringe away. But even you must admit, hugging does have its place. It makes people feel loved. It expresses affection.
Right.
Kids like hugs. Grown-ups like hugs.
There's supposed to be health benefits of some sort, I guess, so that's good.
It probably releases some kind of dopamine in the brain, is my guess.
Yeah, oxytocin, maybe. I don't know what that is, but I know it's one of those good things when good things happen to you.
I have two words for you on this, Rob. Yes? Exposure therapy. You should hug all your coworkers later today.
Who's that, Leo Biscaglia, the hug doctor or something like that back in the
80s? I don't know that.
All right, well, if you see me on the street, send me an air hug. Not the real thing. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.